Hello and welcome back to the Slightly Foxed podcast, brought to you as usual nowadays from London, Dartmoor and Cambridge. My name is Philippa Lamb. I'm in Cambridge, a very beautiful city, of course, but usually very, very car ridden. And it has been fascinating to see it almost empty of vehicles in recent months, you know, looking more like it must have done pre-war. But editor Gail Perkis is in a very different place.
Hello. Yes, I'm sitting at my desk looking out over Lustley Cleeve, which is a stretch of moorland. And it's quiet, except for the sheep. The dogs have gone out shopping, so we won't be interrupted by them. But no, all looking very bucolic down here.
Fellow editor Hazelwood joins us from a classic literary location, don't you, Hazel? Highbury in North London.
I do, yes. As a matter of fact, I could say almost the same as Gail said. I'm sitting looking out over the garden, although there might be noises from the little girls next door playing in the garden.
Yes, I mean, as you say, even though we're not in the office, there may well be noises off of various kinds. We're bringing you another of our occasional Sense of Place series this time, exploring writing about North Africa and the Middle East. Our guest is Justin Morozzi, author, historian and journalist. He's lived and worked and written in Somalia, Iraq, Libya, Afghanistan and Darfur, among other fascinating places. This month's extract from the Slightly Foxed Archive, that will be a piece about Rudyard Kipling's Kim. We'll have book recommendations from everyone at the end, as usual. But now, Justin, welcome. Thanks so much for joining us.
It was lovely to join you virtually.
Now, I mean, as I said, you've lived and written in some very interesting spots. I think today you're somewhere altogether quieter, aren't you?
I'm in a little village in North Norfolk, which calls itself England's Nazareth, otherwise known as Little Walsingham. The pilgrims have gone and it is absolutely quiet.
Now, I know that you read history at Cambridge, didn't you? And you work for the BBC here in the UK. But did you always want to get abroad and write?
I think I probably did, without even realising it first. And I suspect that was partly down to my father working as an exporter. He worked especially in the Middle East and North Africa when I was a young child, and he'd always reappear with these globetrotter suitcases bulging with blood oranges and exotic presents for the family. And I suppose it sowed very early seeds of wanting to travel to this, you know, the same sort of places. He used to go to Iraq a lot as well, and Egypt. He'd born in Beirut and had grown up in the Levant before coming to the UK in the 1960s.
I didn't realise that. Oh, I can see how that would have been very, very tempting then.
Oh, completely. I mean, when he came to Britain to study in Cirencester in the 50s, he was a sort of tall, dark Italian German who'd grown up in the Middle East, really, and met my mother, who was quintessentially English from Dorset. And we were all, the three children were all born in the UK, but there was always that sort of sense of foreignness in the family, entirely through my father and his incredibly eccentric Prussian mother.
Now, I was looking back through your books, and I think your first one, South from Barbary, that sprang, I think, didn't it, from an epic expedition you undertook in the Libyan Sahara. But am I right in thinking it sprang from a book that you found in a bookshop about an expedition, a Victorian expedition?
Yeah, that's absolutely
pre-Victorian,
right.
Pre-Victorian, actually.
And again, that was my father's influence, really. He'd taken me to Tripoli, turning 20 or something like that. And in one of Tripoli's most famous bookshops, which is still going today, I'm happy to report, there was this 19th century exploration of the Libyan interior by a group of Brits, typically, who were also researching the workings of the desert slave trade. And it was a fantastically romantic book describing the joys of travel in the Sahara by camel, the camel caravans, interspersed with really harrowing narratives of coming across slave caravans and the absolutely grotesque conditions that, you know, the human cargo was in.
And this prompted you to undertake an extraordinary expedition yourself.
I thought it's obviously time to go to Libya and buy five camels in a very amateur tradition. And what's, I suppose, funny looking back at it now is that all the people are saying, oh, you shouldn't do that. That's ridiculous. What do you know about the desert? We took a lot of advice, actually, a friend and I, including from the great Wilfred Thesiger.
Did
you? Sort of long been a hero. And we went to see him in his old people's home in Coolsden in Surrey, which was the most unlikely place for this great old Edwardian figure to end his days in. And he was completely discouraging.
Was he?
He said, these days you could do it in a Land Rover. You don't need a camel. Of course, in my time, we had to do it by camels. Your trip is a complete stunt. It's a waste of time. So he was magnificently unhelpful.
Yeah, damping.
We're much younger men in those days and thought, well, to hell with that. We're going to give it a go. We started in Tripoli and headed southeast. My idea, from a literary point of view, was to retrace some of the original journey from the 19th century, but meander a little bit southeast towards Sudan and take in some of the famous oases of the Libyan interior, which were themselves slave trading centres as late as the 19th century. So we made our way with our slightly hapless amateur caravan of 5 camels that we all fell in love with over the next 3 months and travelled 2,500 kilometres or something like that. And it was just the greatest journey ever.
Well, you say that, but it must have been extraordinarily tough.
Well, it was tough physically, but you get used to that quite quickly, actually. And I remember thinking any day you walked less than 20, 25 miles was a bit feeble. There's not much else to do. And by the end of the day, you're absolutely knackered.
Riding a camel is fantastically uncomfortable, isn't it?
Yes.
You're both right. Maybe it's because they're much wider animals than horses. You really have to stretch out your legs. Often you jump off after 2 hours, you'd almost immediately fall to the ground because you're bow-legged. And it was a complete relief and a joy to then just walk alongside the camels for the next couple of hours.
And you said you got fond of the camels, because I've got to say, my very limited experience of camels, they weren't that delightful. Spitty.
I've spent the next 20 years, I think, since that journey, becoming an impassioned defender of camels, and I will hear nothing ill of them at all.
I bow to your infinitely superior experience with these animals.
One of them, we nicknamed him Gobba, slightly cruelly, but he did have this habit of salivating, and you'd be minding your own business, lost under the sun, and then suddenly there'd be this sort of sharp slap of moisture against your face, and it would be this huge thread of saliva that had been billowing through the air from Gobba's mouth. Ew. Landing in your face, and that sort of got you to your senses fairly quickly.
Justin, when you went on this expedition, you've written a piece for us on Rosita Forbes and Husanine Bey, The Secret of the Sahara. Had you read that before you went on that journey?
I think the Forbes I had with me, The Secret of the Sahara, and Husanine Bey, I think, came later in the writing of the book. Both of them lovely books from exactly the same time because they were colleagues. An interesting story of that one is that she completely wrote him out of her account of the desert expedition. She was the very beautiful society Englishwoman. Without
this is early
this 20th sort of
century,
skills.
Isn't it?
This is 1920, I think, exactly. So they both came back with very different books, of which I suppose the finer book is from the Anglo-Egyptians, Ahmed Hassanein's Bay, The Lost Oasis. But they're both lovely, highly evocative books about travel in the desert. One is really by an insider who spans east and west. He's educated at Oxford, but is an Egyptian. And then Rosita Forbes, the very strong-minded Englishwoman.
I mean, Rosita Forbes, for people who don't know her, tell us about her, because she's an extraordinary character, isn't she?
I think she's sort of fallen through the cracks slightly. You know, we all know about Gertrude Bell and Freya Stark. Bell, by the way, was very unsisterly towards Rosita Forbes. She said, in the matter of trumpet blowing, she's unique.
Uh-huh.
She was belittled for her great good looks by a newspaper editor and said, you know, for as long as you look like that, you're never going to get very far.
Because she was a society beauty, effectively, wasn't she?
She was a society beauty. Didn't go to university, unlike Stark and Gertrude Bell. And was never recruited into British intelligence.
Unlike those two.
Yeah. I mean, she wrote many books, probably too many. And in the end, I think she came a cropper. It was a book, I think, published in 1940, Men I Knew, I think, which included conversations with Goebbels, Hitler and Mussolini.
Uh-huh.
There were lots of people who thought that was a step too far. But I think the book we began talking about a moment ago, The Secret of the Sahara, is her greatest book, perhaps, and very much worth a read.
Because she did undertake a pretty formidable expedition of her own, didn't she, in fairness?
Oh, I mean, when she went to Libya, this was absolutely a matter of life and death. And she records the tribesmen saying, you know, if we'd had more numbers, we'd have cut your throats. She was going into a world of feuding tribes, fairly lawless down in the Libyan interior. And had it not been for her Egyptian guide and colleague, Ahmed Husanine Bey, she may well have lost her life. So it does seem a little bit mean of her not to even give him a passing cameo role in the book she wrote.
He was a very interesting person, wasn't he? Because he was educated here in Oxford. But he wrote as an insider, didn't he? And presumably Arabic was his first language, was it?
Yes, exactly. So unlike Rosita Forbes, he was entering Libya as an Arab. He was still a different person, though, you know, from an uneducated Libyan tribesman, this highly educated Anglo-Egyptian who fenced for his country in the Olympics. But a fellow Muslim as well. He wasn't seen as an infidel outsider by the men he travelled among in the desert. I think it's a book that probably isn't read so much anymore, but again, a lovely rediscovery.
This is The Lost Oasis.
The Lost Oasis.
Was it reflected in his writing, that fact that he was an insider, not a European visitor?
Oh, absolutely. When he describes the tribesmen with whom he's travelling, bending down to pray at night and greeting the dawn again under the sky, he writes with a very intimate sort of empathy. And many foreign travellers in these parts who will start talking about, you know, fanaticism or the fatalism of Muslims. And so there's that greater familiarity, intimacy, and knowledge of his fellow travellers.
Yes, because I was thinking some of his Oxford friends presumably, you know, did the same sort of writing, but they must have come at it in a very different way.
Yes, I think that's right. If you think about some of the writers of the desert that we know in this country, whether it's, you know, Lawrence or Thesinger, Doughty a bit earlier, Gordon to some extent as well, there's no one really like him who spans east and west with that same sort of felicity.
Well, yes, I was wondering if there were other writers that we don't know about, really, because they're not available to us, but that you've come across.
I think one of a favourite Arab writer, and in a way I think of him as the Herodotus of the Arabs, even though that's not quite his position, is Ibn Battuta, who is widely available in translation, but is just the most tremendous voice from the 14th century. And what makes him so readable, I think, to this day, is how lively the writing is, and how, just like Herodotus, the first person plays a major role in the narrative. I went to this dhow, I hopped onto this ship, then I had to take an ox, and then I went to this palace, and I had an audience with the Sultan, and he told me this and this and this. And it reveals this amazingly interesting man who's the inveterate social climber, incredibly adventurous, suffered a lot of hardships for his travels, sired multiple children with multiple women on multiple continents. A really picaresque life, which is reflected in the travels of Ibn Battuta. So I think that would be one of my favourite Arab writers.
There's actually a wonderful trilogy by Tim McIntosh Smith, who follows in the footsteps of Ibn Battuta. And he starts in Tangiers, where he was born, to he actually got to Peking. And it is a remarkable story. And I do recommend it. The first volume is called Travels of a Tangerine.
Yeah, that's a lovely trilogy by Tim, whose Arabic is absolutely of the highest order.
Where he's just written an enormous book on the Arabs, published by Yale.
It's huge.
It is huge, but he's well worth it. He writes for us regularly.
I mean, thinking about other indigenous writers, Justin, in the kind of 20th and 21st centuries, is much of that available in English translation?
Some of the classics will be like Albert Hourani, Lebanese writer and historian of the Arab world. And I think more and more the era of Brits or foreigners writing about these places and having the history defined from that very Western-centric perspective is coming to an end, and probably rightly so as well. You know, we're telling other people's stories.
Did these books sort of ring bells with your own experience, really?
They absolutely did, and in one very important way. When I was studying the histories coming to the writing up, which I did in northern Morocco in a town called Chefchaouen, what I was struck by again and again was the almost reverence that these travellers feel for the desert. And each to a man and woman said, once you're touched by the desert, it never leaves you. Variations on that same theme. And, you know, Thesinger, who was a profoundly unemotional man, I think was completely touched by it. So, yeah, that affection for the desert, which I was totally unaware of before this journey, I think was an almost universal reaction.
So where did you go after that, Justin? Iraq? Afghanistan?
I think I just, I'd been as a correspondent, or even I think it was known as a super stringer, for the princely sum of $500 a month plus lineage. So there was a great incentive to write stories in the Philippines. And after 2 years and the second interview with Imelda Marcos, I regarded that as probably that it was time to leave. Yeah, shortly after that, it probably was Iraq. No, actually, it was Central Asia and Afghanistan, to research a book on Tamerlane, which was just a name to me. And as I rapidly discovered, educated Brits would say, oh, didn't Christopher Marlowe write a play? And pretty much that was the best you'd get. Whereas within the Muslim world, whether you're in Morocco or Jakarta, completely household name. One of the greatest conquerors who'd ever lived. And I thought and discovered that he hadn't been written about in English for a long, long time. So that occupied the next few years.
I was interested to see what you were reading yourself along the way, because I think I saw somewhere that you took Anthony Trollope with you and Marcus Aurelius. Is that right?
That was in Mogadishu, much more recently. Yeah, I think they were a little bit of sort of literary therapy to escape from the the strange, surreal environment I was working in, which was actually a great experience in solitude as well.
What were you doing there?
In Mogadishu, I was working as an advisor to the then president, Hassan Sheikh Mahmoud, on behalf of the British government as a communications advisor, which sounds ludicrous, and it probably was ludicrous. But what the great fluke of it really was that I was one of only two non-Somalis living in the heart of Villa Somalia. Most foreigners at that point worked in Kenya and flew in on these little jets. I thought that would be quite dreary. If you want to live in Somalia, live in Somalia and surround yourself with Somalis, which is what we ended up doing, which was incredibly testing, actually, and lost lots of weight, didn't get fed very much.
Well, you wrote about someone else who spent time there, didn't you? The Irish soldier, Gerald Hanley, who wrote a book called Warriors.
That actually proved to be the greatest literary therapy for me living out there. Just a really magnificent book. I'd never heard of it before, but it struck a chord on so many levels. The frustrations, the physical privations.
So this was, Hanley was writing after the Second War, is that right, Justin?
The book was published in 71, but he's describing his experiences about 1943, but serving as an Irishman in the British Army, whose job it was to sort of maintain security among fighting tribesmen. And he was completely aware of how ludicrous his mission was, because he said, you know, that the tribesmen would say, you know, you're lecturing us about our very minor tribal feuds while you're engaging in industrialized slaughter by the millions in Europe.
Fair point.
And as an Irishman for the British Army, I think he approached his position there with more nuance and, I think, empathy for Somalis than a Brit might have done. There was a book published, for example, Douglas Jardine's The Mad Mullah of Somaliland, which is just absolute, you know, typical British imperialist view.
I mean, Hanley became a big admirer, didn't he?
Absolutely, yeah. He was completely impressed by the fierceness, the pride in the culture, the disdain for physical softness or pain. Just incredibly tough people. And so that sort of struck a chord with me when I was among politically feuding Somalis as opposed to sort of physically. It was mostly, Whitehall on steroids, briefings, backbiting, and absolutely vicious politics. Then you read Hanley, who was actually not in Mogadishu, was somewhere he dreamt of being because he was in these really remote interior locations.
Oh, I didn't realise that. Okay.
Yeah, no, that Mogadishu, he writes, was a place for cool sheets, women, cold beers and comfort. And I think he recorded 8 fellow British Army officers who were completely, you know, worn out and harassed by this job, put their pistols to their temples and their head and blew their brains out.
Wow.
Decades later, he returns, I think, in the 60s. So it's again, written with that sort of retrospective look.
Because he was no fan of colonialism, was he? And I think, didn't he struggle to find a publisher for the book?
Yes, that's right. I think it sat in a drawer for about 6 years. It was considered a bit too critical of British Empire.
I mean, he's a fascinating character, but I had never heard of him. But when I did a bit of digging into Gerald Hanley, I realised Hemingway was a big fan, wasn't he?
Yeah, I think he called him the foremost writer of his generation.
And after that, Justin, you then switched focus and wrote about Baghdad.
Yes, living there at the time, I was struck with the great parallels between the whooping and cheering by British figures like Gertrude Bell and then the neocons in America, wanting to remodel the Middle East. And living there at the time and seeing the sort of the fervour of that view was quite, on one level it was horrifying, but with a historian's hat on it was fascinating, watching history repeat itself. Then I had the idea to really write a portrait of the city over the 13 centuries. It's much less old than some of the other Mesopotamian centres. It has a 1300-year history, which is full of glory and great civilisation and absolute horrors of bloodshed and slaughter as well.
Because it was a great cultural capital, wasn't it? I mean, don't the 1001 Nights, aren't they set in Baghdad?
Yes, absolutely. And one of the great characters in the 1001 Nights is Harun al-Rashid. And I think that's why, to this day, he's probably the best known Abbasid caliph who, you know, dons his disguise and then saunters off into the souk to find out what the people are saying. You know, what are the prices like? What's the gossip about the palace and so on and so forth? Full of adventures. And I suppose for 500 years that the Abbasids held sway in Baghdad. And for much of that time, Baghdad really was the capital of the world. It was the greatest city on earth, which had just been founded in 762. So by 1258, when Hulagu arrived, the caliphs had long lost their power, really. Baghdad had rather faded from the scene. The empire had fragmented. And then in comes Hulagu like this whirlwind and absolutely trashes the city. And Baghdadis to this day talk about the city running both red with blood and blue with ink from all the books that were hurled into the River Tigris. I mean, scenes of really indescribable slaughter.
And presumably this is what took you on to your, I think it's your most recent book, isn't it? Islamic Empires. This is history of the whole Islamic civilization, isn't it? Told through 15 cities.
Well, I was trying to really, these days, the sorts of reporting coming from the Middle East is so dispiriting and disconsolate.
Yeah.
People liken it to the 30 Years' War, Arab Spring has become the Arab Winter and so on. So I wanted to really, again, to put the historian's hat back on and focus on more, I don't know, interesting or inspiring times.
So you start in Mecca, don't you, in the 7th century?
Start in Mecca, which I thought is the place to begin the Muslim story. And that also has its sadness as well with the destruction of the earliest Islamic monuments and the creation of this absolutely gargantuan complex, really, of, you know, skyscrapers with jacuzzis and butler services and heliports.
I was so horrified by that, Justin. I had no idea. So this is to accommodate the tourism, the religious tourism of
religious
Hajj,
tourism.
Yeah.
One could say, you know, historically there's at least a continuity in that the Meccans have for centuries made their money by squeezing the pilgrims until their pipsqueak. But the destruction of the historical monuments is tragic, really. But traditionally the Saudi regime has had no interest in that in history.
They've obliterated some of the most important historical sites, haven't they, to make way for hotels?
I think either the Prophet's house or the Prophet's wife's house has become a public lavatory. These millennial-old sites of importance just knocked down in the interests of Mammon, really. The Turkish authorities were very upset about the destruction of an Ottoman citadel. It is rather tragic.
So where else do you go in the progress? As you presumably it's arranged historically.
Yeah, it's arranged historically, so century by century, city by city. From Mecca, the Islamic Empire, it goes to the Umayyads, headquartered in Damascus, a fabulous city. Then Baghdad, Cordoba. I mean, I had no idea that in the 10th century that was probably the greatest city in Europe.
That's an extraordinary, isn't it?
The libraries.
That mosque that was, you know, obviously been turned into a church.
Yes. And there are still scuffles to this day because the Spanish authorities have prohibited Muslims from praying in that, what they would call catedral. It's, I think, more diplomatically known as the Mesquita Catedral.
And you go right through to Doha, don't you, in the current time?
Without great romance, I think, probably for Doha. But I just thought, as an urban phenomenon,
yes,
whatever one thinks about the government, the policies and so on, it is just an astonishing creation of a city from nothing with no expenses spared, in a fairly desperately inhospitable environment and so on. I think Dubai was my city before that, the 20th century, which probably a slightly more interesting creation maybe, with, you know, build it and they will come, was the philosophy. And it worked, you know, amazing.
And maybe in the long term, not viable.
Yeah, quite possibly not sustainable. Yeah, I mean, it's a very strange business model, which looks inherently unsustainable.
I mean, these are contentious places, Justin. I mean, it takes a lot of confidence, doesn't it, to try and define them, surely?
Bold move or foolhardy, you mean, to try to define them?
I certainly wouldn't use the word foolhardy, but I think it's ambitious. You know, I mean, obviously, your sort of writing now, it's vexed territory, isn't it? You know, that criticised as cultural appropriation, you know, post-colonial attempt to explain countries where you don't live, you can't understand them. How do you contend with all that?
Well, I suppose I could just put my hand up on the one hand and say guilty as charged. And I think one newspaper reviewer in America made that sort of point as well. I was only considering Islamic civilization great when it's like the West, which is nonsense. Not something I would have said for a minute. I was trying to make it a point that when the Islamic civilization has been at its strongest, it is also at its most tolerant and self-confident. And the introversion and the sectarian division and all the negative traits we've become known as coincide, I think it's not a coincidence, with times of political crisis, economic stasis, terrible social problems and so on and so forth. So I think that would be a historical verdict that one could make whether you're Muslim or non-Muslim.
Where do you do most of your research?
The British Library, I think, has been almost a second home to me over the years. But what's lovely over the last few years, especially the digitization of archives and material, so that more and more is available, so I can actually spend more time at home.
I was wondering what actually sort of kicked you off on a project, as it were. You know, is it the history? How do you start to think about doing another book?
I think that probably begins with this sort of primeval itch. After a while, I suppose, like lots of people who write books, you start to think, have this terrible itch. Something is wrong if there is not a book on the go. And I've just finished a book about the Arab conquests, but that's a sort of, you know, a quickie of 30,000 words or something. But, you know, substantial project. Like I say, I think it takes a bit of deep breath and, right, I'll see you in four years kind of thing.
Yes.
But yeah, history is the initial impulse.
As we always do, we mentioned a lot of books there. You will find them all listed in the show notes attached to this episode. And of course, if you listen on the Slightly Fox website, you'll also find them there. That's foxquarterly.com. Well, moving on now, I think, and it's time for an extract from the Slightly Fox archives. These are all specially recorded for the podcast, and this one speaks to some of the questions actually we've been discussing with Justin, though it is set in a very different part of the world. Hazel, why don't you introduce it for us?
Yes, this is a piece about Rudyard Kipling's novel Kim, written by Amanda Tennyson. It's about a boy who becomes involved in the great game between the great powers, and it's a controversial book. Some think it's the best book written ever about India, and other people feel it's a sort of embarrassing hymn to colonialism.
When I was a child, locked into the English school system, the only person I wanted to be was Kim, the eponymous hero of Rudyard Kipling's masterpiece. 13-year-old Kim's life in Lahore was everything mine was not. Kim did nothing with an immense success, was hand in glove with men who led lives stranger than anything Harun al-Rashid dreamed of, and he lived in a life wild as that of the Arabian Nights. Even better, I thought, he was an orphan, living his own life unhampered by the tedious entanglements of family. He was free. Though it was not published until 1901, Kipling wrote Kim in 1892, a time when the confrontation between Russia and England on the Indian northwest frontier, which he called the Great Game, was at its height. Kim's father, a soldier in an Irish regiment, had left him in the care of the so-called half-caste woman, who pretended to keep a second-hand furniture shop by the square where the cheap cabs wait. She was an opium addict, and so Kim brought himself up on the streets, speaking English badly and thinking in Hindustani. No one knows he is a white boy, a sahib. He's intelligent, quick-witted, loyal, resourceful, and brave. Able to go anywhere and pass as Muslim or Hindu, he lives by begging and by running dangerous secret errands for Mahbub Ali, an Afghan Muslim horse trader and a spy for the English. One day, Kim befriends a Tibetan Lama and, looking for adventure and new experiences, becomes the Lama's disciple. Together, they go on a quest. The Lama is searching for the legendary sacred river of healing that sprang up where the Buddha's arrow fell. Mahbub Ali gives Kim a secret package to take to a certain Colonel Crichton in Umballa. This is the boy's first unknowing involvement in the great game. By chance, they fall in with Kim's father's old regiment, and the authorities determine to turn the boy into a very reluctant Christian sahib. The seemingly penniless Lama pays for him to go to the best school in India. Then, Mahbub Ali convinces Colonel Crichton, who turns out to be the spy master for this part of India, that Kim would be a natural player in the great game. So, trained in disguise, he leaves school early to go on the road with the Lama again. Eventually, he and the Lama get as far as the Himalayas, where he and another player foil two Russian spies. This summary does scant justice to the book, as well as giving the impression that it is about a boy's transition from Indian childhood to English manhood. It is, but it is also the story of a double quest. The Lama for his river, Kim for himself. What gives it its unique flavour is the vivid word pictures of the characters he meets along the way, and the descriptive narrative that gives an almost physical sense of actually being in India, of being part of that astonishing landscape, that kaleidoscope of warmth, colour, energy, dust and smells. Kipling has been endlessly criticised as a racist apologist for empire. Edward Said, author of Orientalism, described Kim as profoundly embarrassing, and thought it an image of an exotic, obedient, changeless India invented for the pleasure of the West. Kipling was a firm supporter of empire. In Kim, it seems a benign institution, keeping the peace for everyone. This was an idealized vision even then, and Kipling needed to avert his eyes from the injustice inherent in the system. However, he loved and respected the complexity of Indian life, its tolerance and warmth. This is a book where the Indian characters are more interesting than most of the European ones, and the former frequently criticize their rulers. The people for whom he reserved his greatest scorn and contempt were those Europeans who came to India and made no effort to understand the culture or the society. Kim's world still seems very real to me, with its beggars and old soldiers, letter writers in the bazaar, gentle Jane monks sweeping the ground before them as they walk. Kim is Kipling's love song to India, the land and its people. Sometimes I still wish I could be Kim.
Gosh, well, I have to say that Kim is one of my favourite books, and, you know, whatever one has to say about its view of colonialism or otherwise, it is pure romance and adventure.
It is rather loved and loathed in equal measure, though, isn't it? I mean, Justin, what do you think?
I have two little voices in my ears. One of them is saying cultural appropriation, and then the other is, I suppose, thinking that Kipling's is a voice of his time. Think about how many Chinese are currently in favour of the growth of China's influence around the world. Think of how many Americans like to be, you know, reminded that they are the number one country in the world, and so on and so forth. I haven't come back to him for many years, so I was fascinated to hear that as well.
Yes, very Marmitey, I think. He's obviously a Nobel laureate in his own time, as you say, and set much of his work in India. But, I mean, the fact is, of course, he didn't live in India that long, did he? He spent most of his life elsewhere.
Yes, he was only in India for about 5 years, I think, although he was born there and then went back to England to school and then went to work on, I guess, is it the Civil and Military Gazette?
And later on the Imperial War Graves Commission. So that the language used on those beautiful white stones across northern France are Kipling's. Their name liveth forevermore, a soldier known unto God, and so on.
Yes, I'd forgotten that.
As an advisor to the Imperial War Graves Commission.
That was an extract from Amanda Tennyson's article about Rudyard Kipling's Kim. And thanks to the actor Rory Murphy for reading it for us. If you enjoyed it, let us know. We are always interested to hear all your thoughts on, all things Slightly Foxed, of course, including the podcast. You can get in touch through the website foxquarterly.com or Twitter at foxquarterly is the Twitter handle. Recommended reads shortly, but first, a word about Slightly Foxed. Elegant, eclectic and entertaining, Slightly Foxed is the literary quarterly for nonconformists. It introduces readers to all those wonderful books that languish on publishers' backlists but are often very hard to find in bookshops. Among its contributors are distinguished writers and novelists and people from other walks of life, all of whom share their passion for particular books and authors and write about them beautifully. Now, since it's entirely independent, Slightly Foxed is free to follow its own nose and celebrate the offbeat. So why not take out a subscription? £48 for an annual print subscription in the UK and Ireland, and £56 overseas. Your subscription also includes free access to all the back issues in the digital archive. Here's the web address, foxedquarterly.com, or if you'd rather talk to a human, give the office a ring on 020 7033 0258. Thank you. Okay, recommended reads, please, from everyone. Gail, will you kick us off?
Yes, well, I'm going to start with a book about the Great Game. Indeed, it's called The Great Game by Peter Hopkirk, and it was published in 1990. And it starts in 1842 in a dusty square in front of the Emir's palace in the Central Asian caravan town of Bukhara. And the two men are standing by freshly dug graves, and one is Charles Stoddart, a young British officer sent by the East India Company to negotiate a treaty with the Emir against the Russians. Instead, the Emir imprisons him. So a second man, Arthur Connolly, is sent to try to secure Stoddart's release. But he too is imprisoned. Both men are beheaded in the square and buried in those freshly dug graves. And it's basically the story of how Russia advanced south to the Caucasus and east across the steppes of Central Asia. The British in India believed that they were going to attempt an invasion over the Himalayan passes. and it is full of derring do and high adventure and misadventure. Young Indian Army officers were dispatched to try to convince local rulers that they should ally themselves to the British. The Russians did the same in reverse. The British employed pundits who were Indians who could disguise themselves as Muslim holy men or Buddhist pilgrims. Some remarkable characters in it. Alexander Burnes, who became known as Burnes of Bukhara and who was torn to pieces in Kabul in the First Afghan War. France's young husband, who was the first European to reach Lhasa. It's very pertinent to what's going on now with China stretching its tentacles across Central Asia.
It's a fantastic book. And I know Justin must have read it too.
Also love it. Yep. Absolutely.
And I have to say on a personal note, I actually edited it. So perhaps I shouldn't say this.
Did you, Gail?
I did.
It was amazingly yes. well edited, I thought as well.
Well,
that's enough.
He was a meticulous writer. It went through several drafts. He worried about it right to the bitter end. I remember one Sunday evening getting a phone call from him. This is at a time when I had, you know, two quite young children, to say that he'd spotted a misplaced comma. He really threw his heart and soul into it. It's wonderful, and it's still available from Oxford University Press.
Justin, what have you got for us?
I've got a much newer book written about 10 years ago, Travel Writing. I'm going to offer up a Frenchman called Sylvain Tesson, and the book is called Constellations of the Forest, Alone in a Cabin in the Middle Taiga. And that's Taiga. So he takes himself off to live in a tiny log cabin measuring 3 meters by 3 in the depths of of Siberia, and spends 6 months chronicling his daily life. It's a sort of experience in solitude, of mental resilience. And again, I happened to read it when I was living in Mogadishu, and I was mesmerized by it. I thought it was a very romantic book. It might be a little bit Marmite-y as well, but the French loved it. It was a bestseller there. He's been described as France's most brilliant travel writer. And this is, in a way, I think it's more interesting. It's about staying still, struggling against loneliness. And being French, it is fabulously pretentious. He comes to Siberia with a suitcase, Thoreau, Whitman, Lawrence, Nietzsche, Schopenhauer in his suitcase.
Getting the picture.
And bottles and bottles and bottles of vodka.
That sounds like a great recommendation. We are delighted to have a French author recommended on the podcast. Hazel, what have you got?
Well, I've been reading a rather massive biography of a scientist called Alexander Humboldt. It's called The Invention of Nature by Andrew Wolff. I mean, I had heard of Humboldt. I mean, Humboldt University in Berlin and Humboldt Current even I'd heard of, but
yes.
I didn't realise that how incredibly influential and groundbreaking this man was. I believe I learned from this biography that there are 300 plants and 100 animals named after him, including the Humboldt penguin and the Humboldt squid. And he was really the first environmentalist, I suppose, who saw the planet as a kind of whole. He was born in 1769 into a Prussian aristocratic family. He seemed to have an absolutely grim mother. He was rather a delicate person, but he longed to travel. And finally, in 1799, he managed to go on a fantastic journey across the Americas, travelling with cases full of instruments and so on. He climbed what was thought to be the highest mountain in the world at the time, I think, Chimborazo in the Andes. No one had ever gone so high before. I mean, they were sort of nauseous and dizzy. Their eyes were bloodshot. Their gums were bleeding. Their shoes were in ribbons. But they stopped almost every few yards to observe the flora and fauna and take measurements on the edge of precipices. You know, he was the first person to point out the cooling effects of the rainforest, and he warned about man-made interventions. And he also made an amazing journey across Russia, 10,000 miles by carriage, through anthrax epidemics. Everyone of the time seems to have been influenced by him. He was possibly one of the most famous people in the world. Napoleon was a fan. It was through Humboldt's influence that Darwin set out on the Beagle. But really, he was the first person to point out the sort of interconnectedness. Oh, yes, and another amazing account was of him going down under the Thames with Brunel when Brunel was trying to build a Thames tunnel. They went down in this fantastically primitive diving bell. It must have been so dangerous. I think he must have been very hard to get on with. Apparently Darwin, first of all, went to meet him and actually just couldn't get a word in. He went away without saying anything because Humboldt never stopped talking. So to me, he was a completely undiscovered person, and I just found him very fascinating.
It's a fantastic trio of books, I think, particularly for people who are still staying in at this time. Thank you, all of you, very much. They're great recommendations. That is it for this month. Our thanks to Justin for joining us from Norfolk. You must come to Hoxton Square next time, Justin. Tell us about your travels.
I'd love to, and thank you very much for having me today.
Visit the Slightly Fox website to subscribe to the Quarterly magazine. Treat yourself to one of their beautifully produced books, foxquarterly.com. We'll be back on the 15th of August to hear about the trials and tribulations of being a publisher right now with John Walcott from Little Toller Press. Thanks as ever for listening and for joining us on this month's literary expedition, Off the Beaten Track.